Hi, this is Robert Scheer with another edition of Scheer Intelligence. I know it's an arrogant sounding title given to me by the station, but there's no question that we have a great person to talk to about the pandemic. She's, first of all, not only got a history of doing very good science-related reporting, and this one is made for Nova, which is unquestionably the best television documentary series station. It's done for WGBH in Boston, and it's called Decoding COVID-19. And if you have to go see it, you have to watch it. And I did last night, and it produced my first question right now. It's incredibly powerful. It begins in with the epidemic in China. It goes through the world. We see the harsh reality, the battle of scientists. And I went to bed last night enormously depressed that, you know, maybe we're not going to get on top of this. And the scientists are great. They're heroic and so forth. But, you know, this is, I don't know, is it unsolvable? And I woke up this morning to rather cheerful news. This is the day in which it was announced in Cambridge that they may have a new vaccine. And that's actually succeeded in, I guess, 8 people so far to produce antibodies and so forth. At the same time, it's the day in which the World Health Organization was meeting, and the Chinese leader spoke and said, yes, he wants to have an investigation of how it started. He also pledged $2 billion for Africa, which is, as we speak right now, very hard hit. So is Brazil. So the pandemic is by no means over. I want to begin basically with those two points. Is this unquestionably it's among the worst of times in our modern history, but is also a hopeful time in the sense that at least nations are cooperating, at least we're spending resources on. So, what is your basic take, building on the insight you got from the movie?
Well, I'm sorry if you went to bed feeling discouraged, because a lot of people would say to me, it must be so depressing working on a film on COVID-19. And in fact, I found it pretty inspiring. I was really struck by the level of collaboration among scientists. And I felt like in the different areas where we were working, whether it was trying to see if antibodies would protect us, to developing antiviral drugs that could help people that were really sick, to developing a vaccine, I saw a lot of hope and promise. And the news today about the Moderna vaccine, yes, it's only 8 people, but they all developed the right type of antibodies to fight the virus, the right level of antibodies to fight the virus. And it was, and everyone seemed to be have no safety issues. So for me, that was hugely encouraging news.
Yeah, I by the way, I don't want to indicate that your excellent documentary, which I hope goes on to win all sorts of awards deservedly, was depressing overall. The subject is depressing, you know, and it had an inherently very optimistic view about human beings working together, and it didn't demonize anyone, and it talked about the sacrifice of all the scientists and medical workers and ordinary people and so forth. But, you know, it does make it quite clear we haven't faced a problem of this dimension, at least we in the United States. Maybe if we were in parts of Africa or China during different pandemics. But, you know, going back, as the president points out, maybe back to 1918 or something, and it has impressed us with our vulnerability. And it really has challenged the sort of notion of the exceptionalism of America and its ability with technology to solve everything. We've already got over 90,000 fatalities, and that's really quite a marker. And I guess, you know, the film captures that. This is of an order, I think you would agree, that we really haven't quite experienced, at least in the United States, because is that incorrect? Or
no, I actually think you're absolutely correct. And I mean, the 1918 flu epidemic, most of us barely are even aware of or remember. And, you know, I think that all of us felt like that modern medicine had made such progress that surely, you know, we saw SARS, you know, break out in 2002, 2003. It didn't go very far. Neither did MERS. And so we were aware that new viruses were emerging, but they seemed to somewhat fizzle out. The Ebola epidemic outbreak was contained, even though it took a huge number of lives. But this has been quite sobering to watch. And it is a virus that we will be living with for some time, even though there's been a lot of progress right now with just the Moderna vaccine. It will still take quite a bit of time to make sure that this works in thousands of people and that it's safe. And then just to get it deployed, to scale up a vaccine and get it deployed to people around the world. And the Moderna vaccine is a special type of vaccine made from RNA, and it's highly unstable. It needs to be kept at very cold temperatures. And so that's a problem we're going to have to solve to deploy this vaccine around the world, especially to places where it's hard to keep things, you know, so cold.
Yeah, and, you know, my own son, Peter, was in SARS, in the middle of the whole SARS breakout and as an exchange student in Hong Kong. And as a parent, I remember at the time feeling, well, just come home. I didn't have the idea it would spread. I didn't have the idea it would happen in a first world, incredibly affluent society. And he actually corrected me. He said, no, he thought they were doing a good job and he was following the advice he was getting and so forth. And there has been a certain cultural arrogance to this. I don't want to make this an over-politicized discussion, but certainly President Trump has stressed it's a Chinese virus and it brings up wartime analogies. And now there's the other news today, of course, is the World Health Organization meeting. And China, you know, said that they will commit to a serious investigation. You begin your documentary in Wuhan. What insight can you give us about the origin there, the openness of the Chinese leadership? Could you take us just back to the beginning?
We did start in Wuhan. I think the origin of the virus is still unknown. I don't think people do think it came from a lab. I know that's a theory that's been widely spread. You know, it seemed to be circulating in the wet market there, but it probably was circulating in animals and infecting people outside of that wet market. I just think people don't know right now about the origin. We went back to Wuhan because we wanted to be there when the city opened up. They didn't open up until they had really controlled the spread of the virus. They were not reporting new cases. They were closing down their hospitals. And we did follow a 21-year-old college student who was one of the first people to get sick with the virus. He successfully fought it. He began donating his plasma to help other people that were sick. And he was there when the city opened up and we could follow him going back out into the city and just see the incredible control the Chinese have put in place using cell phone technology. You have to scan your health data to leave your apartment building. You have to tell people where you're going. You're tracked. If you're exposed at any point to someone who is infected with COVID, the codes on your phone will change and you're denied access to public spaces. So it is scary for someone in America to look at that kind of level of tracing and tracking. But it shows you that the Chinese are really serious on trying to isolate individuals and avoid shutting down an entire society.
Yeah, and it's interesting. At first, the Chinese model was, you know, put down. You know, of course, they're a totalitarian society and they can do this overreach. And it was sort of dismissed as overreach. But it actually has been a model for much of the world. And it now is, you know, we've gone from thinking of the surveillance society as a negative, you know, Orwellian. Now it's part of the lingo about the way you deal with the crisis, surveillance medicine, knowing everything about our movements and who we eat with. And that's captured in your documentary. And we welcome it. And that's an interesting turnaround, and which I think your film explores.
Yeah, I mean, I hope that we can do it a little bit more humanely. I mean, you clearly saw, we weren't able to include it, but I would see news footage of individuals that had tested positive just being forcibly, you know, shoved into, you know, vans that would take them far away from their families and, you know, under a forced quarantine. It seemed really a little bit draconian. But I do think in this society, until we get a vaccine, what can we control is our behavior. And we definitely need to be ramping up our testing and ability to test people and to trace their contacts and to quarantine the people that are infected to try to slow the spread of this virus.
Yeah, and I think what your film captures is that we're all in the same lifeboat here, or the cruise ship is a better analogy. It didn't matter whether you had the fanciest cabin in the cruise boat or you were working in the kitchen. You know, and you're sharing the same fate and the same virus eventually. And you had that in your picture, depiction of Wuhan. People, you know, maybe they define freedom as consumer sovereignty, as shopping, as, you know, choice in what they went up. But when they had the opportunity to go shopping, it wasn't with quite the same frenzy. It wasn't quite as liberating in that way.
I think people are still worried. And, you know, you definitely saw when the city opened up that people were social distancing, they were wearing masks, and they're being quite careful. I mean, even the young man we followed, he's a COVID survivor. You know, he probably has immunity, at least for a short term. But he knows if he gets exposed, whether he's a survivor or not, he will be facing another 2-week quarantine.
Yeah, and but it also changes our, I know I teach in a college and I chide the students for defining freedom largely in terms of the convenience of shopping or the alternatives and willing to surrender their privacy for the convenience of more effective shopping. But that young man, he seemed properly so. He'd been through this harrowing experience as a survivor. And you could see that he wasn't going to get off on the same notion of freedom of as shopping, that there were other things, family, concern for your loved ones, for your community. There was a notion of security that he wanted now. And that's really kind of been the big shock of all this, that we are vulnerable. Well, tell me more about it, because I think that's the strength of your film. We're meeting people in the midst of wartime, and it changes their outlook.
I mean, one of my favorite stories in the film was the Brown family in Queens. I was quite touched by the palliative care doctor, Alice Beal, who helped that family find a way to say goodbye to their 73-year-old grandfather. You know, she prided herself on never letting a patient die alone. And here she's faced with the COVID epidemic of patients that are intubated on ventilators. Their family can't come in and be with them and they're dying. And she was able to pipe in their goodbye over the intercom. And amazingly, the grandson in that family was an EMT, New York City EMT, Matthew LeBeau. And I found his stories of, you know, being out on the streets of New York City and feeling so overwhelmed because patients were being sent home diagnosed with COVID and they were going to cardiac arrest in their homes and the EMTs would show up and it was too late. Or if they could take people to the hospitals, they'd be waiting for hours before there'd be a bed available. And I felt like it was really important to try to put that on television so people could see if we all get sick at once, we can overwhelm our healthcare system.
Well, but it also seemed, you know, I love that story of the Queens family. First of all, it's great to be reminded we can have large, you know, intact families. You know, sort of. I grew up in New York. It reminded me of big family dinners and everything. You know, the real great, you know, one of the problems we have now is that this is affecting older people who are more vulnerable. And then there's even some thinning of the herd theories. And this was a family that really worshipped the grandfather. I mean, they honored him. He was central, and suddenly he's going to be ripped out of this. And they could not talk about him without crying. Right. It was really quite moving, and a sense of loss, and that, you know, whatever security they had or whatever, that wasn't going to cut it. That the vulnerability, the fact that, you know, we are mortal, and your, a couple of your films and your work have dealt with this sort of threat to the perception of human existence. It's, you know, whether it's superbugs or this one, or saving people who are on an excursion or what have you, you're up against this, something that we tend to deny in our every moment. It's always about career or economic security or consumption. And this pandemic reminds us of the frailty of the human experience.
You know, Dr. Osterholm, who we interviewed in the film, said to me at one point, and I don't think I was able to include it, he was talking about, as we try to figure out the number of fatalities we might have, if, you know, if we lock down, if we lift the lockdown, and he said, you know, these people, there are grandparents, there are colleagues, there are neighbors, they're real people. And that's what I loved about the Brown story, was that George was a real person, and you could see how active he was in his children's lives, you know, missing, you know, not missing a single basketball game, or, you know, going on every outing with these kids, a real part of their lives. So I think it's easy just to say it's a number, but in fact, they're real people and missed by, you know, the families around them.
Yeah, and the other thing that comes out in your depiction, it's not so different being in Wuhan or being in New York City, that we all have the same fears. Our governments have the same confusion. They struggle with the same kind of problems. And there was a common message in this that I hate to say that a pandemic is enlightening, but it really has shocked the major conceit of modern existence, that with the right job, with the right money, with the right connections, and if you're in a first world country or if you're in an emerging successful country like China, that somehow that will define the meaning of your life. And suddenly, the very reality of your life is being challenged.
I think Naheed Bedelia said it in our interview, we are connected. You know, a pandemic can be an airplane flight away. What happens in one country could, you know, is headed towards our own country. And this virus is now in 50 countries around the world. So, you know, she really made the argument that, you know, you have to care about what happens in other countries. And we need to have a much stronger world health system. So if an outbreak does emerge, you know, I think we now understand how important it is to try to isolate it and contain it before it spreads around the globe.
Well, that is, for my mind, one of the powerful messages in your film, because it's not just a super dangerous virus or a super bug or something, and it's that we live in a multinational world. We are so interconnected. You really can't put up walls. I mean, that has been the big shock here, is how rapidly, there's no such thing. Yes, you can wall it off if you act collectively, internationally, with transparency, and let science decide, and, you know, but otherwise, just putting up customs barriers or something, it won't work anymore. That is really what is different about this pandemic, isn't it?
Well, I mean, first of all, you have to realize we're dealing with a pathogen that's spread by the air we breathe, you know, that can live for up to 3 days on the surfaces we touch. And so one of the montages we put in the film was just when you begin to see the movement of people across this planet, the elevators, the escalators, the airplanes, the trains. I mean, and the fact that this virus was carried by people who didn't know they were infectious. It was most contagious before people got sick. And that's so different from Ebola or SARS or MERS. So people were spreading the virus and not knowing they were sick. And that's and it was also, you know, carried by the air we breathe. So two really, really difficult things that made this virus, you know, wreak such havoc.
Time for a break, and we'll be back in a few minutes. We're back with Sheer Intelligence and our guest.
I should say, by the way, I'm talking to Sarah Holt, one of our great documentary filmmakers. This was made for Nova, with, you know, for WGBH, the great PBS station in Boston, maybe the most creative one for this kind of documentary. And Sarah Holt is the writer, producer, and director of really this compelling documentary, Decoding the Virus and What's Been Done About It. But I do want to stress, at least for me, what the documentary got to me was that we're all in on it. There are no walls. And I just, that's why I brought up the SARS epidemic. I remember when my own son was studying in Hong Kong, there was a feeling, oh, well, just get away. It won't chase you. And he did. He went off to Korea at some point because his school closed down and he was safer in Korea. Well, that wouldn't be the case now. We're just too interconnected. And as you point out, the viruses are different. And we should talk a little bit about that, because this is no longer just a reason to say, yes, let's have World Health Organizations, let's have the UN, we have to work at these things. As I said before, today, the leader of China, instead of taking a xenophobic attitude or our way or the highway, said, no, I have to worry about Africa, and I have to allocate money for Africa, and I have to agree to transparency. And I think that's one of the things that's coming out of this pandemic, and I think your film gets that across.
You know, people had been warning ever since the 19 flu epidemic that we were at risk for another pandemic. And, you know, every few years we're seeing new viruses arise, whether it's Ebola or Zika, MERS or SARS. And people were waiting for a pathogen that would be airborne and, you know, highly contagious. And that's what the coronavirus is. I would just like to say one thing, though. This film was made in 6 weeks. You know, normally on a Nova, you have 12 weeks just to research a subject. You have 9 months to make a show. So even though I am the writer, producer, director, it took a team, executive producer Chris Schmidt, Julia Court. There were 4 co-producers. There were 3 editors. There were fact checkers. And so it was really an incredible effort. And when they first asked me to get a show on the air, I didn't think we could do it in 6 weeks. And they said, we will help you. So it was really a team effort, just like the scientists that I was seeing out in the world collaborating. Everyone at Nova came together to help get this show on the air.
Well, let's give a plug for Nova. Tell me about the world of the documentary filmmaker, because there's a power to the documentary that we tend to forget, and which anyone watching this film will get it. It goes beyond the news clips. Yeah, we see people being wheeled into emergency rooms, but you're able to provide context. It's thoughtful. It is respectful of the science. It's educational, not to damn it with praise, but it's highly educational. It's a 1-hour primer on what's going on, the very thing we're not getting from watching endless, you know, cable television or whatever, you know, and endless debates and arguments. There's a clarity to it. And, you know, so just what's the story with documentaries now and Nova?
I feel incredibly privileged when I get to produce a Nova. I mean, Nova sees science as this powerful human intervention that helps us decipher the physical world, but also find solutions for some of our biggest challenges, whether it's climate change or opioid addiction or this mysterious lethal pathogen. So we took This film is a scientific investigation into this novel coronavirus. You know, I don't think people understand there are more viruses in our world than there are stars in the universe. Luckily, most of them are harmless. We have viral remnants scattered throughout our DNA. One scientist said to me, you know, we're part virus. We have viruses that live on our skin that attack bacteria that might be trying to invade us. We have viruses living in our microbiome. So the viruses that are dangerous are the ones that jump from animals into humans that we haven't encountered before. So this is a novel virus. It's not new to the world, but it was new to us. So the show looks at viruses, how they infect our cells, how our immune system responds. It looks at, you know, how we try to develop antibodies, which are proteins that can detect an invader and stick to that invader and call in the immune cells to, you know, destroy these invaders. And then the whole science behind vaccines and how they work, trying to help us develop antibodies to the pathogen. So there's a science story that's woven throughout the story of what happened in China, the story of, you know, medical workers and EMT workers on the front lines. And then we also look at, you know, people trying to develop antiviral drugs as well. And then people that are just studying antibodies, because everybody wants to know, if you've been exposed and you've developed antibodies, will you be immune? And we really don't know. I mean, there's the coronavirus head cold that you can get, and you're only immune for a year. I think when you got SARS, you were immune for 2 years. So we have to study these antibodies to find out if you get sick with the coronavirus and develop the right kind of antibody, how long will they protect you?
So even the vaccine that, as I say, we're having this conversation on the morning when the World Health Organization is meeting, and also when there's, for once, some cheerful news about developing a vaccine, we're probably still, what, at least a half a year away from it, even if it all works out, being able to distribute it. And as you point out, it's a vulnerable vaccine that has to be kept under very special conditions. But you're now sort of dampening that by saying even the vaccine might have limited, might necessarily not be like the smallpox.
Well, so you may need to get booster vaccines. I mean, if you get measles, you have immunity for life. If you get a measles vaccine, you don't have to get another one. But this could be a vaccine you may have to get every 2 years. I think there's just so much we're learning every day. Every day I open up the newspaper or open up my computer, and there are new things that we're discovering. So it's, you know, it doesn't mean that a vaccine isn't going to be useful. It just means you may have to get a booster vaccine. Just like we get a yearly flu shot, you know, we may need to be getting, you know, a yearly or, you know, every 2 years of a new vaccine for the coronavirus.
Yeah. So, you know, as we wrap this up, let me editorialize a little bit here. What I loved about watching this film, it was for me like, after all, you know, watching all this stuff, on, you know, I'm trapped like most people in my place, you know, my apartment, and I'm inundated with alarmist sentiments of one kind or other and over-politicizing and scoring points. And it was like taking a refreshing cool bath watching your documentary. I didn't feel assaulted. I didn't feel manipulated. I didn't feel I was being sold one line or another. And I actually was experiencing science at its purest in a journalistic form. And I know that, you know, sound like I'm just being puffing it all up, but I really felt that. I felt liberated by your documentary, and you know, what really reminded me of is the value of logic, fact, real news. And I would blame, you know, this, I'm not going to segue into an attack on our president when his talk about the invisible enemy and the Chinese virus and his overpromises, because you get it from all sides. And you get it from the sensationalism and why don't we have enough masks and what about this and who failed that? And what, again, I want to get back to the value of the documentary as a form of journalism. I know in my own teaching at the Annenberg School of Communication and Journalism, I show documentaries all the time. They seem to me inside job on on the banking meltdown, fog of war, you know, on what happened in Vietnam and so forth. You go right through the whole thing. I wanted you to talk about your art form in relation to this, because it seems to me you've provided a really important alternative way of teaching, of learning about something that is so contentious right now.
You know, I think for me, I feel like I'm a facilitator. I try to find the people that I think are doing the most important work and get them on the air and let them speak for themselves. I'm not, compared to those scientists, I'm not an expert, but I feel like that I was able to find some of the people that I think are doing the most important work right now, and I gave them time on national television, and I let people spend time with them and get a sense of the experiments and the studies they're doing and hear them. And to me, I feel like my job is to bring out the best of those people and to get it on the air. And also, even like, for instance, you know, the doctors on the front lines, the fact that that palliative care doctor found a way to allow the family to say goodbye and have closure. So I just feel like that I'm kind of in service to something that's much bigger than me.
Well, and that certainly is the well-deserved reputation of Nova and the Boston PBS station, WGBH. You know, I don't know how they do it, but it seems to me they hold up real well for decades, doing consistent, great journalism. I want to thank you. I've been talking to Sarah Holt, who's made a really incredible movie. And, the good thing about the internet, I've discovered you don't need the special code to get it, right? And anybody wants to see Decoding COVID-19, I'm sure you can find it fairly easily. And by the way, I don't want to give a plug, but it's probably a good reason to support public television and radio, because they get the stuff out there. And Sarah Holt is, you're being modest, I think, because your record shows that being the writer, producer, and director, you probably had a great deal of being able to make this. Really, right now, it's the most significant thing one can look at in terms of this pandemic. It's cool. It's rational. It's moving. But it doesn't keep slapping you in the face and trying to present an alternative message. But that's it for this edition of Sheer Intelligence. Our producer at KCRW is Christopher Ho, does a great job there. Natasha Hakimi Zapata writes the intros for these. And Joshua Shear, as usual, is our producer and set this all up. And I want to thank him. See you next week with another edition of Sheer Intelligence. C'est payé, balayé, oublié. Je me fous du passé avec mes souvenirs. J'ai allumé le feu, mes chagrins, mes plaisirs. Je n'ai plus besoin d'eux. Balayer les amours avec leur trémolo, balayer pour tout.